Okay, so I wanted to discuss today the tripartite agreement. This was inspired by a proposal that a friend of mine made, rabbinic colleague of mine, made a number of years ago to resolve aguna situations. We've spoken in the past about the interaction between the law and the ritual requirement for a husband to give his wife a Jewish bill of divorce, a get, according to Jewish law, and how there sometimes is a tension or an intersection between the giving of a get according to Jewish law and the civil divorce process, and we spoke about how that plays out in the courts. And we also spoke at that time about how certain states, like New York, for example, have enacted legislation that helps to ensure that when a Jewish couple is married, that a woman won't be left in the lurch, won't be kept an aguna, according to Jewish law. That means a chained woman who can't remarry is called an aguna, based on the husband not giving her a religious divorce, based on not receiving a get. Because according to Jewish law, even if a couple has a civil divorce, that does not automatically translate into a religious divorce. And even with a civil divorce, the couple, the parties, are prohibited from remarrying unless a get has been performed as well. Now, because of the fact that this is a very thorny issue, and the rabbinical courts don't have enforcement power really to require a get to be given in a case where one party, usually it's the wife, asks for a get, and the recalcitrant party is usually the husband. Sometimes it's the other way around. I have cases like that in my rabbinical court as well, where the husband very much wants to give his wife a get, and she wants to hear nothing of it. Or they have various terms where they say, even though we have a civil divorce, now that you're taking me to a rabbinical court for the get, I want to revisit other issues as well. I want to revisit custodial issues. I want to revisit financial issues, and otherwise I'm not going to cooperate with respect to a get. So because enforcing the giving of a get can be very, very difficult, there's been a recent movement in which a group of scholars have tried to devise ways in which there could be what they refer to as a systemic solution to the get problem of having a built-in system, a built-in mechanism whereby a get would automatically be triggered, would automatically be given whenever a marriage would dissolve, whenever there would be a civil divorce between a couple, somehow the get would automatically follow as well. This is a very tricky thing to try to devise because according to Jewish law, a get has to be written very, very specifically through the authorization of the husband. And it has to be written by the husband or written by a scribe who was authorized by the husband to write the get. And then the husband himself has to deliver the get, the Jewish bill of divorce, into his wife's hands, or he has to have a shliach, have a duly authorized agent of his, deliver the get into his wife's hands. And therefore, you can't just do away with the get. For example, under Jewish law, it would be impossible to say, well, we stipulate that this marriage won't require a get. That's called masne mashikasu b'torah. That's called making a condition against that which is explicitly required according to biblical law, according to the Torah, which the Talmud tells us that it is ineffective. You're allowed to make conditions when it comes to monetary matters. You're not allowed to make conditions when it comes to ritual matters. You can't make a condition between the two of us. We agree that it's going to be okay to violate the Sabbath. Between the two of us, we agree it's going to be okay to eat pork. You can't make that type of a condition. You're not allowed to supersede the laws of the Torah. So here as well, a couple can't make a condition. We're going to get married on condition that it won't be necessary for us to perform a get upon the dissolution of the marriage. That simply doesn't work. The couple is considered to be married, and there still is a requirement for a get. So over the past century, as this issue has become more and more prominent in people's minds, there have been different proposals that were made to try to come up with what we call the systemic solutions, according to Jewish law, to prevent these problems of recalcitrant husbands refusing to give their wives a get or the other way around. Usually, in 90% of the cases, in my experience, when there's one spouse who is being uncooperative, who's refusing to cooperate with the get, it's usually the husband. Why is it usually the husband who's failing to cooperate? Because according to biblical law, at least, the woman is not allowed to be married to more than one husband, but a man is allowed to be married to more than one wife. Remember Yaakov, Jacob married two different sisters, right? Rachel and Leah. So we know that a man is allowed to marry multiple wives according to biblical law. Even though this is not permitted according to rabbinic law, it's not considered to be an act of adultery if a man would then go off and marry another woman without a get. And because it's only rabbinic law, there was a Chayrim de Rabbeinu Gershom about 1,000 years ago. Rabbeinu Gershom came along and said a man can't marry more than one wife. One wife is enough. That since it's only a rabbinic enactment, it can be overridden by the rabbis. The rabbis can say, okay, we prevented you, and now we're going to permit you. If we have a case where a woman is acting in a particularly obstinate and unreasonable fashion, so then built in to Rabbeinu Gershom's enactment was an escape clause, which says that if 100 rabbis from 3 different countries or even 3 different provinces here in the United States, it could be 3 different states. We know every state counts. Look at the past election a month ago, right? You know, it counts. So even if it's 100 rabbis from 3 different states, you get them from Florida, Illinois, and New York, and you're covered, say that they think that a particular case warrants for a man to be allowed to remarry without his first wife receiving a get, particularly if she's refusing to receive one, so a man can procure such a dispensation. Therefore, men are less worried in cases where a woman would refuse a get, and therefore there's less leverage for a woman to refuse a get from a husband, and the consequences are also not the same either, because if a child would be born from a second marriage of the man, assuming he's not married, he's not going to engage in an adulterous relationship with a married woman, he just marries a single woman who's eligible, according to Jewish law, to marry, so the child of that union will not be illegitimate. But if a woman remarries without receiving a get from her husband and she marries somebody else, so then the child of that union will be a mamzer. That child will be illegitimate. What's so bad about being illegitimate? Who wants to be illegitimate? But besides that, being illegitimate carries with the consequences. It means that the child who's the mamzer would not be allowed to marry freely other members of the Jewish community. They would be severely limited in terms of whom they could marry. They could marry pretty much nobody. Very, very few exceptions. And even the exceptions wouldn't want to marry them, generally speaking, because their children will end up being mamzer and will end up having the same status in most cases, and therefore, this is a situation that under Jewish law, you would go to great lengths in order to prevent. So a rabbinic colleague of mine presented what he called a tripartite agreement, a three-way solution or a three-part solution that could resolve all potential aguna situations, and I wanted to just explain why, even though with the best of intentions, one can come up with a proposal and a possible remedy, that if it has all kinds of holes in it, maybe sometimes you're better off not pushing a proposal altogether, especially if people are going to rely upon it and it's not going to work at the end of the day. So the three parts of the proposal go like this. First, every single marriage would begin with a condition. That there would be a condition made between the husband and the wife that in the event that this marriage works out, then all is fine and good, and it's a good marriage. But we make a condition, not that the marriage won't require a get. That won't work according to Jewish law, as we said. We make a condition that in the event that the marriage dissolves and we become separated from each other, and after 15 months, the husband has still not given a get to his wife, so then it will turn out that this marriage was never valid to begin with. In other words, I'm marrying you on condition that in the event that we become separated, I will give you a get within 15 months. If we become separated and I don't give you a get within 15 months, so then it turns out we were never married to begin with. So that's the idea of making a tanai b'nisuin, of making a condition in the marriage. Not saying that it's a condition as to whether you need a get, But it's a condition in the marriage. This marriage is being entered into conditionally, which at first blush doesn't seem like such a terrible idea, because the Mishnayos in Maseches Kiddushin, in the Gemara, talk about all kinds of conditions when people got married to each other. A man would get married to a woman on condition that she didn't have any physical blemishes. So you say, Hare ani mekudeshes, Hare at mekudeshes li, amena she'en lach mumin. You are hereby betrothed to me on condition that you don't have physical blemishes. Turns out she has physical blemishes, no marriage, right? Or a woman says, I'll agree to marry you on condition that you stated that you are very rich. Turns out he's not very rich, right? So then the whole thing is off. So it would seem that you can actually make a condition. One of the most famous conditions is a person who says to his wife, I'm marrying you on condition that I'm a tzaddik, that I am a saint. So the Gemara says, so if it turns out that the person is a scoundrel, so is the Kiddushin invalid as a result? So the Gemara says, no, the Kiddushin is still valid, because maybe at that moment in time that he made the condition, he repented in his mind. And then afterwards, he went back to his evil ways. But at that moment, he repented. So therefore, maybe the marriage is really a good marriage. So it depends on the condition. But we see there's such a thing as making conditions. Yes?
Yeah, a question. You're talking about a condition that would invalidate the marriage altogether. This isn't including the conditions of a delivery of a conditional get, like they talk about at the beginning.
No. That's something else entirely. Okay. Conditional get is when a couple is definitely married, and the husband wants to give a conditional get. Here's your get, but only on condition that I don't return within the next 30 days. So we say that actually could be done, but it's very, very complicated. However, what do you gain from that? That's only, you know, if you have we'll get to that. Why that doesn't work. Right. Yeah. So this is the idea of entering into the marriage based on condition. Now, the problem with a regular case of marriage nowadays is that all the cases that were discussed in the Mishnah and the Gemara about making a condition was when there was a separation period between the time of betrothal and the time of the consummation of the marriage. Meaning, what's the consummation of the marriage? You're standing under the chuppah, and then the husband and the wife are sequestered together. They're alone with each other. That's what we call the yichud after the chuppah. But what it really means is that the wife and husband are living with each other as husband and wife. They wouldn't be living with each other. The period that we nowadays call engagement, in the olden days, they were actually considered to be linked to each other. They had a betrothal. They were considered married, but it was not nisuin. It was not what we would call a full-fledged consummation of the marriage. There would be around the 12-month period. Right now, when the ring is given from the husband to the wife under the chuppah, that's betrothal. And then when they have all of the brachos, the blessings under the chuppah, and they go to the yichud room at a wedding, so that's considered to be the nisuin. So we do one right next to each other, the other. The only thing that we have in the middle is the reading of the ketubah, but otherwise there's only maybe a 3-minute separation between the kiddushin and the nisuin. But in the olden days, there was a much longer separation, and therefore the kiddushin was considered to be a little bit more fungible than the nisuin. What's the major difference between the kiddushin and the nisuin? Well, when they get married, they consummate the marriage. They're living together as husband and wife. So the assumption was that once people are living together, two spouses are living together as husband and wife, they don't want their marriage to be conditional, because they don't want all of their intimate relations to be labeled or categorized after the fact as having been promiscuous, as having been out of marriage relationships. So therefore, the general assumption is what we call ein tnai b'nisuin. This is, you know, in the materials here, source number one. That is what the Gemara in Yevamos states, that ein tnai b'nisuin, there is no condition that can be made when you have an actual nisuin, when you have an actual consummation of marriage. So the first component of this proposal that was made assumes that you can make a tnai b'nisuin. You can make a condition in the act of a nisuin itself. Even after a marriage has been consummated, it can still be conditional that maybe at some point in time, if the condition is not fulfilled, then the marriage will retroactively be void. So there were a number of rabbis in France at the turn of the past century, the turn of the beginning of the 20th century, who wanted to come up with this brilliant idea. They said, well, generally speaking, why is it that we say Ein Tanai B'Nisuin? We say Ein Tanai B'Nisuin because of the fact that the condition that was made at the time of the Kiddushin, of the betrothal, does not necessarily remain in effect at the time that a couple is going to be living with each other, because we assume that they don't want their actual intimate relations to be conditional. But let's say that they say explicitly that they're willing for their intimate relations to be conditional. So then there are certain authorities. These are authorities that are quoted in source 7, source Zion, at the bottom of the page over here by the Beis Shmuel, famous rabbinic commentator on the Shulchan Aruch, where he says that maybe if you explicitly made a condition right before they're about to lie down with each other in bed and they're going to have relations with each other, that they say even these intimate relations will be conditional upon the fulfillment of certain conditions, so maybe then it really will work. So some authorities said that it could work in such a situation. So we don't find in the halacha, we don't find that this is brought down in the Shulchan Aruch anywhere, but the French rabbi said, look, it's the 20th century. We're about to enter the 20th. This is going to be an amazing century. Everything's going to change in this century. So, you know, why don't we change this too? So, you know, what a great way to start the century. So they said, and the way we'll do it is like this, that since everybody who gets divorced in France gets divorced with a civil divorce, it's just that some of these people don't know about doing a get, or they become so secularized they don't do a get, or a husband withholds the get out of spite or for leverage, or the same reasons why this sort of thing, you know, might happen nowadays. They'll make a condition that they're only getting married on condition that they'll never be civilly divorced, but in the event that they become civilly divorced, it'll turn out that they were never married. That was the tonight. That was the condition that they wanted to make. So Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Inspector, who I believe his, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Inspector was the greatest posek. He was considered to be the greatest halachic authority in Europe during his time, during the end of the 19th century. He's also the namesake of Yeshiva University. Yeshiva University is named Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. So because he died around the time that Yeshiva University, or at least the yeshiva part of Yeshiva University, was founded in the late 1900s, around 1896, that's when the Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan was created. So he had just passed away, so they named it based on his memory, based on his legacy, Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. But Yitzchak Elchanan Inspector screamed and yelled that this is a complete violation of the sanctity of Jewish marriage, and to the idea that you're going to do away with the need to ever have a get at the conclusion of a marriage, because the marriage will just automatically blow up and dissolve, is unthinkable and preposterous and reprehensible, and this should not be considered in any way, shape, or form. And there were a number of rabbis at the time who were solicited by a very well-meaning Rav, well-meaning and well-doing Rav, by the name of Rav Yehuda Lubetzky. I've never really come across his name in other contexts, but it seems like what his major contribution to the rabbinic world was that he compiled many, many tshuvos, many, many responsa from different rabbinic authorities regarding why this proposal by various French rabbanim was null and void and should not be considered. And he put together a sefer. He put together a book. At that time, it was like a pamphlet. And the name of the pamphlet was called Ein Tanai B'Nisuin. You can't make it, just like the Gemara Yevamos that we have here at the beginning of the sources says, Ein Tanai B'Nisuin. So he says this is not just a pithy, you know, convenient phrase mentioned in a limited context in the Gemara, but this is a sweeping principle that you can't do it. You just can't do it. So different rabbis gave different reasons and explanations as to why it couldn't be done, but just the lineup of rabbis who contributed to this volume, it was a veritable who's who in Europe who contributed to this volume, was itself remarkable. So it included Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, it included Rabbi Meir Simcha Midavinsk, included the Telzerov of Eliezer Gordon. It included the Divrei Malkiel. It included Rav David Zvi Hoffman. It included the Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan. It included Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, who became the greatest posek in Europe in the early 20th century, and included Rav David Karliner. So if I had to, you know, sum up the different objections as to why we would say why these different rabbinic authorities were opposed to this idea, so Rav David Karliner really captured all of the different reasons in his contribution to this pamphlet. And to summarize, there were five different objections that the different authorities had. So one objection was that this is just a runaround in terms of making a condition against that which is in the Torah. Fundamentally, you have people who are married up until the time in which they decide that they're going to get divorced. It's not like they decide to get divorced the moment that they get married. And the Torah says that the only way to end the marriage is by a husband giving his wife a get. And this is a runaround. It's like you're making a condition to say the marriages can terminate without a get. And therefore, it's masna mashikosu b'Torah. It's making a condition against that which is in the Torah. Number two, there are opinions, and this is quoted as well in the Beis Shmuel Sor Zion over here, and it's found in the Shiltei HaGiborim, which is a commentary that you'll find on the side of the riff in the back of the Gemara. So Shiltei HaGiborim says very clearly that even if it was decided by a couple at the time that they performed the Nisuin, at the time which they consummate the marriage, about to get into bed with each other, about to have intimate relations with each other, and they make a condition, and they say all of these intimate relations and this nisuin is going to be conditional upon certain things happening, it still doesn't work. He says the reason why you don't find this codified anywhere in the Shulchan Aruch, that it's possible to make a condition past the time of the Kiddushin, at the actual time of the nisuin, is because it just doesn't work. And you know the reason why it doesn't work? It doesn't work based on another Talmudic principle, and that other Talmudic principle is called Ein Adam Osa Bilaso Bilas Nus. A person, as we mentioned, does and not want. A man, when he enters into an intimate relationship, he does not want that intimate relationship to turn into an act of promiscuity. He wants it to always, forever, be labeled as a marital act of intimate relations and not as a promiscuous extramarital or premarital act of intimacy. A third reason is that this idea that some of the Rishonim presented that you could conceivably make a condition even at the time of intimate relations, that's really hard to do from a logistical perspective. You're going to have, like, witnesses standing there, and they're going to be, like, you know, recording the exact condition, and they're going to, as you're, you know, going into this incredibly, you know, intimate situation, he said it's going to be really, really difficult to coordinate logistically and pragmatically, and nobody's going to know how to do it properly, and you'll get the wrong people involved. Therefore, just from a pragmatic perspective, even if it could work, it really, even if it could work conceptually, it would not be able to work pragmatically. And then the two last reasons were policy considerations. And what's interesting is that if you go through this Sefer, the Sefer has an interesting history, because when most of the various responsa and letters were obtained from the different rabbinic authorities in the early 20th century, it was privately presented to the rabbis in France, and it was going to be a huge embarrassment to them that all of the world's major rabbinic authorities opposed what they were doing, and also thought that they were incredibly out of line to engage in this type of a proposal. So it was suggested to them that if they just quietly withdraw their proposal, it won't be necessary to publicize this whole business any further. And they quietly withdrew their proposal, and therefore it was felt by the rabbis that there's no need to memorialize this unfortunate incident for all of posterity, and therefore we don't have to publish the book. However, Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski himself, in the around 1930, took it upon himself to publish this Sefer, which he had in his possession, and he was the force behind the eventual publication of the Sefer. And it is widely thought to be the case that the reason why Rav Chaim Ozer felt that it became necessary 20, 30 years later to publish this Sefer was because there was a new proposal that came from the Rabbanei Kushta. Who are the Rabbanei Kushta? The rabbis of Turkey. The rabbis, a number of rabbis of Turkey, came up with their own proposal where they said, oh, well, the proposal of the rabbis from, you know, France may have been rejected because it was tied in to cases of civil divorce and it had no real religious justification to say specifically in these cases we're going to enact a condition that's going to be tied with civil divorce, and it makes it look as if we're just trying to substitute a civil divorce for religious divorce and say a civil divorce is as good as it gets. But instead, we'll say that if certain very specific conditions are satisfied, only then will the marriage be made conditional, and would we say that if any of these events happen, it'll turn out that there was never a marriage. Like, for example, a husband goes far away on a trip without his wife's permission for a long time and doesn't return within a certain amount of time. Or he refuses to give his wife sustenance. He refuses to provide mizonos, to provide support for her. Or he has a contagious disease or a very serious psychological ailment. Or he converts, he apostatizes to another religion. Or he dies and she'll just end up having to do chalitza with his brother because he dies without any children. And he has a brother, and we're worried maybe the brother's not going to do chalitza. So if any of these five cases, that was their proposal. So it appears that Rav Chaim Ozer saw that this idea of entering into conditional marriage or proposing conditional marriage was not going to go away so easily. And once he saw that it wasn't going to go away so easily, he felt that it is a mitzvah to publish this sefer. So that was what caused the eventual publication of the Sefer. So if you look at what a lot of the Rabbanim were concerned about, it wasn't only the three halakhic conditions or considerations that we mentioned, that it's considered a condition on what's written in the Torah, that it doesn't work conceptually or that it doesn't work pragmatically, but they had two policy considerations as well. The two policy considerations were that every single woman will clamor for a divorce because now it's going to be much easier to get a divorce. It used to be that the husband would have to agree to give his wife a get, but now that it was that the volition is being taken out of the husband's hands, so what wife isn't going to want a divorce at some point in time from her husband? So they were worried that, you know, everyone's going to start petitioning for a divorce. It's going to become an epidemic. And a fifth concern was that people will have much less of a sense of sanctity about Jewish marriage. That since it would be known that the marriage could be blown up, so even, let's say, a woman would commit adultery during the course of the marriage, she wouldn't have to be worried that it's going to be adultery, because as soon as she says that she wants out from the marriage, it'll turn out she was never married in the first place. How convenient. So it'll turn out that the adultery wasn't really adultery. So these were that it will just cause what they considered to be a debasement of a Jewish marriage, that people will be mizalzil. They will have less respect for the notion of the sanctity of Jewish marriage.
To get around the halakhic problems, you know, inside of the suin, so couldn't you just make it that you give when you get married, you give a get right away that's like a conditional get, you know, that only takes effect if, you know, certain conditions are met, you know, that they're not living for 15, not living together for whatever, 15 months or something like that.
So that's the second part of the proposal. As I mentioned, it's a tripartite proposal.
Okay,
so the first part of the proposal is this idea of Tanai B'Nisuin. That's the first part of the proposal. As we mentioned, Tanai B'Nisuin has a long-storied history, it turns out, and it was soundly rejected by every single rabbi in Europe at one point in time. Rav Yosef Elio Henkin, who was the premier posek for American Jewry, had his own proposal as to how he was going to resolve aguna issues. And he threw in, it wasn't a major part of the proposal, but he threw in and he was also thinking about this conditional get, you know, type of thing or whatever, but he threw in that maybe you can also take into consideration the possibility of enacting or implementing a condition at the time that a couple gets married with each other, and maybe if they're explicit about making the condition effective even for Nisuin, maybe that could really work. And then he got a hold of this pamphlet that Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski had published. He didn't know about this pamphlet. It's not like they had Hebrew books in those days or whatever. And, you know, people didn't necessarily know about everything that had been published. He got a hold of this pamphlet. So when I wrote my proposal, I didn't know about this total rejection by all of the rabbis in Europe of an idea of making a condition at the time of Nisuin. But now that I know about it, Hadribi, I have completely retracted from my proposal. In fact, there is a book called Kisrei Rav Henkin in which all of his writings are published, and he publishes his proposal with crossed out lines on every single line of the proposal. The whole thing is a giant redaction. It's a giant, you know, cross out, because he wanted to make it very clear that he had charata, that he regretted even making the suggestion that a conditional marriage could work according to halacha, and therefore he completely and categorically withheld or withdrew his suggestion. And he, in later writing, said that he came around to the position, like the Shilta Yagiborim, that conceptually it just doesn't work. Based on the principle of Eina Damosa Bis Biloso Bilaznus, he says even conceptually, nobody would want to go into marriage with this possibility that all of their chaye issues, all of their intimate relations, will just be turned into the equivalent of what he calls a revocable contract. That nobody has that conception of marriage. When you get married under the chuppah, that you're entering into a revocable contract, and therefore he said that the whole thing is null and void for that reason. But that was the first component of their proposal, of this new tripartite proposal that was suggested by a friend of mine, a rabbinic colleague. His name is Rabbi Broid. You've heard of Rabbi Broid. And he has, you know, a couple of others who have joined forces and think that, you know, this is a great idea, because if you're looking for a systemic solution, it creates a systemic solution. So he himself recognized that this is not considered to be something that works according to most authorities. It was rejected in the Sefer Ein Tanai B'Nisuin by all of the great rabbis of Europe. It was rejected by Rav Chaim, even the adjusted or amended version of the rabbis of Turkey was clearly, you know, something that Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski was attacking when he published the Sefer 20 years later. Then Rav Eliezer Berkowitz, who was here from right here in Chicago in the Hebrew Theological College, came up with his own variation of this around 1960. He came up with his own variation, and he wrote a sefer, and the name of his sefer, as opposed to the previously published Kunturis, which was called Ein Tanai B'Nisuin, so the name of his book was called Yesh Tanai B'Nisuin. It was, oh, maybe we really can make this work, Yesh Tanai B'Nisuin of Beget. And his argument was, maybe it only doesn't work when the people are doing it on their own. But we know that everybody gets married Kedas Moshe Yisrael, according to the laws of Moses in Israel. So let them say that it's in the hands of the rabbis. If the rabbis should decide that the condition should be valid in a particular case, that we're only entering into the marriage as long as the rabbis are happy with this marriage. But in the event the rabbis will ever be unhappy with this marriage, it'll turn out that we were never married. They said, put it completely in the hands of the rabbis. This way, you are not diminishing the sanctity of the Jewish marriage. You're not making it into a revocable contract between the parties. You're giving the authority to the rabbis themselves. So he has an approbation in his sefer, in his book. He has an approbation by Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, known as the Sri Deyesh, who was certainly considered to be an eminent rabbinic, post-war rabbinic authority. You know, the Sri Deyesh lived in Switzerland during most of his life, or at least after the war. He was he ended up in Switzerland, and he had a very interesting personal history himself. He himself had difficulty with finding a good shidduch, shall we say. Not entirely clear what happened. He was briefly married for maybe a year or less, and didn't work out, never got remarried, but, you know, he was somebody who could be very sympathetic, I guess, to, you know, a predicament of someone who would be, you know, trapped in a non-functional marriage, just as a historical footnote. And he originally wrote to the Hakdama, he originally wrote the introduction to the book, Yesha Tanai Ben Nisuin by Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, in which, and if you can get yourself a copy, you know, in the library or something, of the Sefer, it's not one that you'll find in the bookshelves of your average base medrash, but, you know, you go to maybe the, I was at Yeshiva University a little while ago, and I asked if they had a copy of the Sefer, and they had to, like, bring it to me, like, from the basement or something. It was, you know, one of these rare books, almost, you know, one of these books that are difficult to get a hold of. It actually had an inscription in it by Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz himself, and but that was the copy that they had, so that was interesting. It was an inscription from Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz to Dr. Chaim Dov Shevel, who was the author of the translation of the Ramban al HaChumash, you may recall. So Rabbi Weinberg said, look, this is something that was rejected, but maybe in this new form, it's something that could be reconsidered by the poskim at the rabbinic authorities of today, and especially since it has become much more of a widespread plague in this day and age, he said, that you have situations where couples are getting married Jewishly, but they're not getting divorced according to the proper requirements of Jewish law. So therefore, it's probably a good idea to revisit this proposal, particularly in revised form. So it turned out, however, that the prominent rabbinic authorities at that time did not look kindly upon this proposal, and one of the major opponents was Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer was the editor of the Torah Shlema, right? Which is a sefer. I'm sure that Menachem Mendel Kasher. Got to, it's 100 years earlier. Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. He didn't have anything to do with this. But Menachem Mendel Kasher wrote a very stinging rebuke, and he claimed that even the Sri Deyesh himself retracted his haskama, because the haskama, the approbation, was based on, number one, consideration that maybe rabbinic authorities will reconsider, but they didn't reconsider, and number two, that this was really a different form of the proposal, but it wasn't really a different form of the proposal that had been made, because the original proposal of the Rabbanei Kushta, and even if you look carefully at the wording of the proposal of the French rabbis as well, had a built-in clause that this had to be in any given case in which the condition would be implemented, and therefore the marriage would be declared null and void. It would have to be at the determination of the rabbinic authorities that this would be carried out, and it wasn't something that the couple was just doing between themselves. It had to be Kedas Moshe V'Yisrael, and nonetheless, all of the rabbis rejected the proposal anyway. So therefore, the only, you know, saving grace that one, you know, could possibly take away from this idea of Tanai B'Nisuin is that as much as everybody has always tried to shoot it, you know, and make it dead in the water, it always seemed to have some type of resuscitation, either through the Rabbanei Kushta or Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz. There were those who felt that maybe it could be looked at again, it could be reconsidered. I remember one of the rabbis at Yeshiva University returned to me a few years ago when we were talking about possible solutions to the Yaguna problem, and he also said to me, maybe, you know, this is something that can be reconsidered, you know, the whole idea of Tanai B'Nisuin. So that's the reason why it's at least considered to be, by Rabbi Boyd and others, as something which could be, you know, part of the a general formula towards a resolution or a systemic resolution of the Aguna problem. Now, what are the other two components? So the other two components of the resolution go as follows. That in addition to having a conditional marriage, that there also be not just a conditional divorce. We say conditional divorces are tricky because many of the rabbinic authorities say we don't even do conditional divorces nowadays because the rules and regulations of how to give a get on condition are so complicated that we're worried that we're not going to do it correctly, much like the pragmatic consideration that some of the poskim mentioned in connection with making a Tanai B'Nisuin. But just make an authorization, a conditional authorization, that you could do. Don't give the get right away, but have an authorization that the husband gives to his wife. They get married, you know, here, Harei HaMekudeshes Li Kedas Moshe Yisrael, you're hereby married to me, and we'll stick together through thick and through thin, and through good times and bad times, till death will we part, etc., etc. And by the way, here's your get. That the get will be delivered at the actual inception of the marriage, but not through an actual handing of the get, but an authorization, where the husband says, I authorize for a get to be written, but I don't authorize that it's going to be written today. I authorize that in the event that we become separated from each other, that we become separated from each other, so I authorize that at that point in time in which we are separated from each other and my wife requests a get, and a bezdin determines that it's the proper thing to do for me to give a get, so I authorize that a get shall be given at that time. But the authorization is done right away. So therefore, there's what we call a hersha'ah. There's an authorization for a get to be written. In halakhic parlance, this is sometimes referred to as a kisvu utenu, where the husband doesn't actually write a get right away, but he authorizes the giving of a get to be written at a later point in time. And this is something which was done very often, very frequently, for men who went out to war. Like, for example, during World War II, during the Vietnam War, it's referred to even in the Gemara as well, during the time of David HaMelech, that every single husband who would go out to war would write a get to his wife. What does that mean? He would write a get to his wife. So some say he would just write a get to his wife. And then if he would return from, because there was a fear that he would get lost in battle and we wouldn't be able to identify the remains, and a woman would become an aguna for that reason. So therefore, he'd give her a get. If he came back for more, so then he would remarry her. Others say that's a bad idea for any man who's a Kohen, because if he's a Kohen, he's not going to be allowed to remarry his wife because she'll be a grusha, and a Kohen can't marry a divorced woman. So others said, well, you know, maybe the idea was like this, that either a get was given conditionally, that a get was given on condition that if he returned from battle, then this would not be a get, but if he didn't return from battle, this would be a get. Or another way of doing it is just for the man to leave behind an authorization that says that in the event that he doesn't return, say, within 12 months of when he leaves for battle, so then a get will be given, will be written. He'll appoint the sofer, because a husband has to appoint the scribe to write the get. He has to appoint who the witnesses are, who will sign the get, who the agent will be to deliver the get. He appoints all of those individuals, but it's not done until a later point in time. So this was the latter formulation, or this last formulation, of not giving over a get when a man goes off to war, but just leaving behind the get authorization when he leaves for war. That was done by many men with the approval and at the recommendation of a number of American rabbis at the time during World War II. It was also done during the Vietnam War. And in fact, when I worked at the Beit Din of America, I even found in the files of the Beit Din of America a few get authorizations for men who left for battle during the Vietnam War. Went off. Remember, they still had a draft at that point in time, and you had, you know, more Jewish soldiers who were going off to the army, or going off to the war at that point in time, even religious Jewish soldiers, potentially. That's when there was a spike in the number of applicants for smicha, for rabbinic ordination in those days, because that was one of the ways in which you could get exemption from the Vietnam War. If you want to know what really brought back religiosity to the American Jewish community. And even in the recent Persian Gulf War, when there were men going off to battle the Persian Gulf, I remember I was working at the Beis Din at the time, and we formulated these forms for men who were going off to battle as well, usually they were chaplains. The chaplains who were going off to the Persian Gulf War, they would execute these forms just so that they would be available in the event that, you know, God forbid, something would happen and they would get, you know, lost on the battlefield. Yes.
But wouldn't authority also dissipate at the time of death so that it couldn't be written after someone dies?
After he dies, you don't need it. After the man would die, okay. You wouldn't need it. But the real problem case would be where you don't know that the man died. Well, you think he probably died. Maybe he was taken as a prisoner of war, and he didn't die. Either we know he's a prisoner of war, and the wife doesn't want to, wait around forever until he's released. Maybe he'll never be released. So we don't even know if he was taken as a prisoner of war. We just don't know where his whereabouts are, what happened to him. This was also done by Tzahal, by the Israeli Defense Forces, by the IDF, at the beginning of the establishment of the State of Israel. But very quickly, the rabbinic authorities who were involved or engaged with the military in Israel decided that it was bad for the morale of the soldiers, and they put an end to this practice. So starting from really the Israeli Independence War, they began to do it, and then they immediately put an end to it when they felt that it was bad for the morale of the soldiers. So now it's not done in Israel as a matter of course anymore, although occasionally a soldier will go to his local rabbi and do it anyway, but it's not done as an automatic practice within Tzahal, within the IDF. So that was, proposal number two. What's the problem with proposal number two? So the problem with why it is that nobody else came up with this great idea was because there is a major assumption, and this is codified in Shulchan Aruch, it's codified in the code of the Jewish law as well, that if a man authorizes a get, and then he lives with his wife afterwards, it's assumed that he has nullified his authorization. Because normally, why does a person write a get to his wife? Because he wants to divorce her. So if he lives together with her with intimate relations afterwards, that shows that he doesn't really want to divorce her afterwards. Maybe he's changed his mind and he wants to stay together with her. That is one, objection. And it's codified in Shulchan Aruch that as a result, the get cannot be presumed to be efficacious. If a get would be written after it was authorized by the husband, but between the authorization by the husband and the living together of the husband and the wife, the get was the man in, the man after the authorization by the husband, he lived together with his wife, and then only afterwards the get was written. So it's assumed that you can't rely upon such a get. So again, you have to raise the question. So what then is being accomplished by raising this proposal when it seems sort of obvious that this is it's not going to work? So here, the authors quote that maybe one could potentially rely upon a tshuva by Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog. Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog was the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel. And he also had to deal with this conundrum of what do you do with men who go out to war, want to spare their wives from being an aguna by authorizing a get, but let's say they have a furlough. Let's say they have a furlough, and then they're allowed to spend the weekend with their wife before going back into the army. Do they have to, every single time they have a furlough and they're living together with their wife, do they have to assign a new get authorization form? So Rav Herzog suggested that maybe if it's explicitly included within the authorization that this is not the intention of of the husband to nullify the authorization to write the get if he should ever live with his wife, then the authorization would remain valid. So you just write within the authorization, even if I should return every now and then and live together with my wife, this authorization will still be valid, and my wife will be believed to say that I never nullified the authorization. So the authors say, look, if Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog said that that could work, so maybe that could work even for a tenai, for a condition, at the very inception of the marriage. The problem with that is, not everyone agreed with Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi Herzog that it works. And number two, he was talking about where at the time that the get was written, it was written for the purpose of saving the wife from being an abandoned army wife whose husband is missing in action. And it was written with a very specific intent that he really wants, out of his love and affection for his wife, he really wants to deliver the get for that reason. And that love and affection, therefore, is not contradicted by the fact that the man is now living together with his wife in the middle of this mission to the battlefield where he comes back for a furlough. However, in the case of a man who's doing this at the very beginning of the marriage, He is saying that in the event that we're not going to have love and affection for each other, so then I'm authorizing a get to be written. So that requires a complete change in his mindset, where at the time that he's authorizing it, his view is, I'm never going to get divorced from my wife because of the fact that I have love and affection. I'm not going out into the battlefield. It would only be necessary for a get to be given in the event that the relationship between them deteriorates, but that hasn't happened yet. So therefore, Rav Henkin himself, when such a proposal was made by conservative rabbis in the 1930s to have this type of an authorization for a get at the very inception of the marriage, he said the major problem with having this proposal at the very inception of the marriage is that you don't have gemiras das. You don't have a real full fledged commitment on the part of the husband to give a get, because the only time the get will have to be given is if the marriage deteriorates. And when a couple enters into the marriage, we would hope that their expectation is that the marriage is not going to deteriorate. That's why they're getting married to each other, that the expectation is that they're going to remain committed to each other and they're going to maintain their love and their affection for each other. So therefore, the entire condition in this particular case never gets off the ground. Secondly, in the case of the furlough, the authorization was basically, you know, still in effect, and there's only one very short fling in which this very short window of time in which the husband and wife are able to be intimate with each other when the husband comes back for a weekend or something like that, but the situation has basically remained stable, as opposed to a case at the beginning of the marriage where the husband and wife are going to be living with each other day in and day out for years and years, we assume. It's not just a one-time thing. And over the course of a relationship, over years and years, it can be presumed that the man did not have the same intention for the authorization to remain valid. And as I said, it's brought down, it's in Shulchan Aruch itself, it very, very explicitly, it is cited that such an authorization would not work. So fundamentally, what the proponents are really relying upon is the third component of the tripartite agreement. The third component is Afkiinun Rabbanan L'Kiddushin Mineh. Has anybody ever heard that term, Afkiinun Rabbanan L'Kiddushin Mineh? It means that the rabbis themselves sometimes have the power to nullify marriages. And the Gemara has several cases in which the rabbis were given this authority to nullify marriages, to say that a marriage that was properly entered into is null and void. So they said, so at the time in which the couple gets married, they'll stipulate that in the event that they're separated and 15 months pass and a get is not given by the husband to the wife, then the marriage, forget about a condition. The rabbis themselves will decide that they're going to nullify the marriage. They'll treat it as if there was never proper consideration given at the time of the marriage. If the man gave his wife a ring, they'll declare that the ring is hefker. And they'll declare all of the intimate relations to be promiscuous in nature, and the rabbis have the ability to do that. The problem with that is that, as the Rashba points out, already one of the Rishonim points out, and as the later authorities point out as well, every single time that the Gemara talks about Afkiinun Rabbanan L'Kiddushin Mineh, there is some sort of a get that the husband has given, and not a get that we say is completely null and void, because the husband lived with his wife after he made the authorization, or because there was a condition in the marriage that we don't even view the condition as a valid condition, but where there is a actual get at the time in which we want the woman to be divorced, is an actual get at that point in time, which is commissioned by the husband. It's just that there's a side problem with the get, like you spoke about a conditional get, where a husband gives his wife a get and says, this is your get, if I don't return within the next 30 days. And now, 30 days later, he's about to return, and he's about to go over the river to his town, and the bridge collapses. So he says, I would have come, it's just the bridge collapsed, so what do you want from me? So we say, even though normally a person can make the argument that if there was a circumstances beyond their control, an onus, that prevented them from keeping a condition, then they're not going to suffer the consequences of the fact that the condition was not satisfied. When it comes to a get, since it looks like a get, and it looks like the condition wasn't satisfied, we're going to treat it as a valid get anyway. But At the end of the day, he gave his wife a get, and the condition really was satisfied. We're just saying that we're not implementing the normal rules of onus, the normal rules of duress, or shchimera. A man who's on his deathbed gives his wife a get, and the understanding is that if he gets better from his illness, then the get will not be effective. That we say, even if he gets better, the get is still effective. But there was this condition that was built in. We say, yeah, but not everyone will necessarily understand that condition. Maybe the wife will go up and marry somebody else. We don't want it to be adulterous. We treat it as a good get. But what else is true about that situation? What's true about that situation is that there was an actual get that was given. And here you don't even have something that amounts to an actual get. You have at best an authorization at the beginning of the marriage where we say that this is not considered to be a get at all. It's considered to be a null. It's considered to be a completely invalid get. It's null and void. At best, it's a dubious get. We don't find that this type of takana, this type of enactment of kinum abanan kedusha mine, works for even dubious getin. The one case where the rabbi said where you can make a condition in marriage was a case where, like the fifth scenario that was suggested by the rabbis of Turkey, and that was the case where a man dies without any children, and the wife would otherwise have to do chalitza with the man's brother. But even then, they qualified it. They said, you know what, you can have a tanai b'nisuin, provided, this is codified by the Raman Shulchan Aruch, provided that the brother was a meshuman. The brother was somebody who never would have done chalitza because he apostatized to another religion and would never participate in a Jewish law ritual. And this was expanded by other authorities to a brother who doesn't have mental capacity, that he is developmentally disabled and would for that reason not be able to do a chalitza. Or he was missing. We don't know what happened to him. Maybe he's dead. Maybe he's alive. We don't want the wife to be stuck because we just have no idea as to his whereabouts. In those limited situations, they allowed it. Why did they allow it in those situations? So Rabbi Yehuda Lubetzky in his Sefer, Tanai B'Nisuin, makes a very astute observation. He said, what is the fundamental underlying reason why we would say that even conceptually speaking, a Tanai B'Nisuin, a conditional marriage, doesn't work? That's because Ein Adam Oseh Bilas or Bilas Nus. A person does not want their intimate relations to be rendered promiscuous. When does a person care about that? If he's still alive. If the only time that they're going to be rendered promiscuous is after he's dead, so then he doesn't care anymore. So therefore, it could work. You can make a conditional marriage, but you can only make a conditional marriage in that type of a situation where the marriage would only be made null and void after the husband is dead. If the husband is dead already, the woman doesn't need a get. The only time that she would need a get is if she was in some type of chalitza situation, and then we've already allowed to enact it. We've already allowed for its implementation. But even then, only in those situations, the post can point out, where no woman would want to marry this man. The man would basically be stuck without any woman being willing to marry him because they don't want to take a chance that he's going to die without children. And the brother-in-law, who they know will never do chalitza, will never do chalitza. So therefore, you can't even expand it to situations beyond those cases where you know that the brother-in-law will never do chalitza because he's an apostate or because he's developmentally disabled or because he's missing in action. Yes?
Is there ever ketubah written that there's different value to the ex-wife in the sense of a get as opposed to a widow situation? That the value is different. I mean, I can imagine that it may... that when the economics would get into it, that if I divorce you, you get X amount. If I die and you're a widow, you get Y amount.
And generally maybe, not because the ketubah is the same.
And maybe the get part is higher or lower. I mean, you might say in going into it that you might have it lower because that's the situation where I don't like you anymore. And then it makes it different.
The ketubah amount is the same whether a woman would receive a get or whether she would become a widow. One could argue that it's advantageous to be a widow, generally speaking, because then a woman has the choice where she could say, instead of receiving my ketubah, I'll just be supported by my husband's estate, you know, for as long as I continue to remain single. And that is our general assumption. The general assumption is that a woman would rather be a widow, and for a totally different reason as well, because this way she'd still be allowed to marry a kohen. Unless she would be in a chalitza yibum or chalitza situation where she would be linked to the brother-in-law and there's a fear that the brother-in-law is not going to perform chalitza. So then we say that's a different story, and the Gemara already anticipated that. That in that situation, a woman would prefer a get, but otherwise she would definitely prefer being an almana. The other case where she would prefer being a get is where she would be an uncertain almana, where she's pretty sure that the husband's there, but she's not 100% sure, and as a result, she's going to be an aguna, like in the army situation, unless she has a get, in which case she'll definitely be able to move on with her life, mimanav shach, meaning either the husband's dead, or if the husband's not dead, so then she has the get. So that's really insurance in such a case. So, you know, the one observation that I would, you know, that I would make, just, you know, since really none of these things could be relied upon, you don't, and the other condition of Afkeinu is that you need all the rabbis to agree. So the Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenburg pointed out there must be a reason over the millennia of Jewish law that you don't find that the rabbis automatically triggered Afkeinu Rabbanan Kiddushin Mine to resolve aguna situations. Otherwise, in every single case where a husband was missing at sea, they would have said Afkeinu. And that's because you need some sort of a get. So we understand that. So, you know, the important thing is with respect to all of these solutions is that it's a good idea to try to come up with solutions because we want to. We say Shaktu Chachamim Al Takanas Benos Yisrael, that it was always a priority of the rabbis to try to rectify aguna situations and to provide for the security of Jewish women who are married so that they can get out of non-functional marriages and be able to remarry, you know, whenever it is appropriate. However, in order to really be compassionate on behalf of those who would otherwise be in aguna situations, it's also extremely critical that it works. Because if it doesn't work, what ends up happening is that people will enter into these types of agreements and they'll rely upon a get which ends up not being a valid get. Or what I found in other contexts, when there have been other faulty proposals in the past or defective proposals in the past, is that sometimes the husband, who otherwise would have given a get, will say, why do I need to give a get to my wife at this point in time when she already has, you know, the dispensation from these rabbis who say that the authorization that I made at the time of the marriage is considered to be sufficient. So it actually can end up being potentially counterproductive. So this is yet another reason why, in my opinion, the best solution is still entering into the prenuptial agreement. I'm not, you know, trying to push a particular product just because the CRC has the prenuptial agreement, but so does the Beit Din of America. But this is something that really has been endorsed by rabbinic authorities. At the end of the day, this solution that was proposed, the tripartite agreement, will only work if the husband signs this at the time of the marriage anyway. And if you think about it, especially the get authorization part, he can't do before he's married, and he doesn't have the ability to, you know, point to divorce her himself before he's married to her. It'd have to be after the marriage, and who says he's even going to do it? You know, even if it's under the chuppah, maybe, you know, 2 minutes after the chuppah takes place, he's not going to want to do it. The prenuptial agreement can be signed prior to the marriage altogether, and the prenuptial agreement just says the parties agree that they're going to submit to the authority of a Beis Din, and they'll abide by what the Beis Din decides. There's case law, Avitzor versus Avitzor, Goldman versus, you know, Goldman here in Illinois, that says that, you know, if you enter into these types of contractual arrangements, it can be enforced even by the secular law authorities. And it provides for a financial incentive. It says the husband will support his wife for $150 a day, which is a cost of living calibrated support obligation, so it's not punitive in nature. That would be a Jewish law problem otherwise, which provides for, as long as they're still married according to Jewish law, which provides for a strong incentive to give the get as soon as possible. And we know that that works in virtually 100% of the cases where it's been signed. So why come up with a different solution that would require the same type of compliance of entering into it at the time of the marriage anyway, when it clearly, you know, is much more dubious, is much less likely to be effective, and you have another solution which is in place. But I do think that there is an obligation to utilize whatever solutions are in place. You know, one of the proponents of this movement who looks for a systemic solution, I'll conclude with this, for, you know, the aguna problem is the expression that where there's a rabbinic will, there's a rabbinic way, right? So my own retort, you know, formulation of that would be that where there is a halachic way, there ought to be a rabbinic will. So what we need to look for is what are the halakhic ways, and then we have to use the rabbinic willpower to make sure that everybody is employing those halakhic ways in order to prevent aguna problems in the future.
What about the situation we've heard about in the news about, extorting a get out of a husband, either physically or financially? Does that figure into it? Because then you don't really have the intent. Or another way to look at it is to do that and say now the presumptions, the chazakah is going to change so radically after the status changes that the proving that you didn't have intent is going to be a much more difficult situation. Doesn't there need to be actual intent and so that kind of community force?
Yes. One of the most important criteria for giving a get, according to Torah law, is that it has to be given voluntarily. It has to be given of the free will of the husband. But if the husband entered into a contract in which he said he's going to support his wife, which he's supposed to do anyway, and he just chooses to give a get to get out of that support obligation, that is a volitional decision on the part of the husband. That's not considered to be coercion. Coercion is only when we would impose upon the husband something he otherwise wouldn't be obligated to do, or we subject him to physical force in order to provoke him to give a get. But if none of those indicia are present, then it would not be considered to be a coerced get, and it would not be problematic from the standpoint of Jewish law. I mean, those rabbis who ran around, you know, using cattle prods and things like that, so that's much more problematic. There are situations where Jewish law allows physical force, but they're very few and far between.
In this country, the civil authorities seem to disapprove of such behavior.
Yes. You also, you know, will probably end up in jail if you, you know, exercise those tactics as certain rabbis have learned.
There are still segments of the Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox community that does not